Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing a show I didn't want to ever have to play. It's a memorial to a very special, very unique, very dear, very missed Jimmy Huskins. Choreographer, painter, gourmet cook, teacher, mentor, raconteur, beau vivant, dearest friend, loved by all, who left us way too soon, a very short time ago. I interviewed Jimmy, as he will say in this interview, when he was closing in on his 75th birthday, and little did we know we only had 5 more years with him. But every minute with Jimmy was worth it. So, this is Jimmy talking about his life. Hang on, here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice, oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
The Lynn Show is about being who you really are, not being some version of yourself, some idea of yourself, not presenting to the world the person you think the world wants you to be, or the person you think the world will accept, or want, or like, or love, or pay, you know. As a psychotherapist, it is my experience that so many of us are pretending. We're pretending to be smarter than we are. We're pretending to be prettier than we are. We're pretending to be thinner than we are. And a lot of that we're doing consciously because we can manipulate that some. You know, I give the example of, you know, laughing at a joke that you didn't really understand, but you knew when the punchline had been said that it was time to laugh. Well, I know a lot of people who are afraid to say, oh, I really hated that movie, until they've waited to hear what everybody else has to say about it. So these ways in which we pretend to be something we're other, so many of us are doing this, you know, consciously, intentionally. We are attempting to look different so that others will, as I said, like us, want us, appreciate us, accept us, pay us. But there is a more insidious way in which many of us are behaving as someone we are not. This happens when, in childhood, we were discouraged from being, doing, saying, acting, thinking, feeling something that we did. Think, feel, say, act, believe, behave. You know, you've heard the, no, you're not really angry, no. Or, you know, don't cry, I'll give you something to cry about. All of these, some subtle, some not so subtle, ways of teaching us that something about us is unacceptable. Something about us is not going to bring what we want. And of course, as children, what we need. And also, as children, what we deserve. Which is acceptance of the person that we really are. Unfortunately, so many parents had parents who discouraged them. And so when they see some of the behaviors that were discouraged in them, in their children, they behave very much the way their parents did and let their children know that this behavior, this way of speaking, this idea, this thing you like to do, it's not okay. Once that has happened sufficiently, strongly enough, we not only try to pretend that we don't have that, we actually can come into adulthood forgetting that we did have it. So people forget that they used to be able to stand up for themselves and say what they think. People forget that if they were sad, they could cry. People forget that if they were angry, they could demonstrate anger. People grow up feeling that life is not safe, that people can't be trusted. These are deeply held beliefs, which are not the ones we came in with. So the Lin Show is about making this point. It's about saying that the closer you can be to the person you really are, the easier, more delightful, happier, probably more successful, but certainly the most enjoyable life you are going to live. And what I am trying to say with this show is that if something happens in this show, something I say or something somebody I interview says, that triggers an idea, a memory, a thought that maybe there is a part of you that you have been in denial for, it may not be too late to recover it and therefore to be the person you really are. The interviews I do are with people who make their living or their life with an art. I do this because we make it really tough for people to make, never mind a living, even to dedicate parts of their life to the arts. Lots of families will think it's charming, clever, interesting, adorable if they have a child who likes to sing or dance or draw. Or don't think that's a career. Don't think that's a life, just because it's what you love and what comes naturally to you. So those people who hold on to that stuff, either because they had parents who didn't discourage them, or because they had help in one other, another form, those people who hold on to that are people who are, at least in the aspect of their work, who they really are. And when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. To use the psychological term, they are congruent. What you hear is what there is. And of course, it's my hope that listening to that will inspire you if you have had to bury something about yourself, to think about that and maybe recover it. Today's interview is with Jimmy Hoskins, who left us just a few days ago. And Jimmy would certainly be the poster child for The Lynn Show. Jimmy Hoskins could do everything. He could dance, he could sing, he could act, he could write, he could paint. He was a wonderful cook, a marvelous storyteller. And he did all of that in his life, in addition to being a teacher and a mentor and a very, very dear friend. He did everything that he was. And in this interview, you'll hear it. You'll hear the ease, the pleasure, the delight that was Jimmy Hoskins, because he could afford to be delightful and easygoing and happy, and because he was living his life. He was living the life he was born to live. You will hear Jimmy talk about the support he got from his mother and his aunt just to be himself. I said in the run-up, Jimmy's death is a terrific loss to everyone who knew him, and everyone who knew him loved him. So, here, in his own words, Jimmy Hoskins. Okay, so here I am with Jimmy Hoskins in his beautiful house.
Thank you.
I interview people who have made their living or their life with their art, and I know that you have.
Yeah, fortunately. Mm-hmm.
And my goal, my intention, is to find out how you found what you consider to be your art. So how did you find it? How did it find you? How did it happen?
Oh, that's golly. I started tap dancing when I was 6. You want to go back there?
Yeah, I do. I do. Why? Do you remember?
Yeah, because all the kids in the neighborhood were taking.
Tap dancing?
Yeah.
Where did you grow up?
In St. Louis.
And all the kids in the neighborhood were taking tap? That's kind of unusual,
isn't
it? It
was in the suburbs of St. Louis. Yeah, I think it is. But we just all ran around together, and we all started taking tap dancing, even the boys.
Wow.
And we had such fun, and I was the only one that kind of stuck with it.
It got you.
It did. And I danced all the time, but I was also an artist. I loved to paint.
Fine artist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I grew up with all of that, and dancing, and
so it was
paint.
Accessible to you for
yes,
from
and
the
I
beginning.
Was always encouraged. My mother had an all-girls orchestra in the 1920s.
Wow.
Called McManus Melody Maids, and her brother, Les McManus, was a horn man, trumpet player, with Ray Garden and Freddie Slack Boogie Band and Stan Kenton, and so I was always involved in popular swing music and all that, mother ragtime, and she loved Dixieland and mm-hmm. all of that.
So there was always music?
Always. In fact, she would have us clean house to music. And she really developed my brother and my ear, because she would have us clean house to certain areas that we were listening to. Like, for instance, she would say, all right, Jimmy, you dust only when you hear the trumpets. And Bill, you dust only when you hear the reed section.
Wow.
So we would wait, and we'd hear our part, and we'd dust, and we'd stop, and we'd stop. So our ears got so attuned to how to listen to an orchestra.
Uh-huh.
And so that was very fortunate. In fact, I've used that in teaching through the years. You know.
The dusting?
No, being able to hear.
Oh. Yeah, well, so all right, okay. So 6 years old, you started.
Yeah, so anyway, that took me through high school, and I would dance in high school and do musicals.
So you knew you always wanted to do this. This was what you were
going
to
do? I always wanted to be in the arts. I knew that. I didn't know exactly. I never put
a title on it.
Like I say, I want to be an artist. Because I wanted to be an architect. And I have spent 15 minutes of wanting to be a minister. And,
it's a performance of sorts.
Yes. A little through things like that. But anyway, I went away to college and majored in fine art. Mm-hmm. And started dancing a lot, performing there. And I liked that a lot, so I quit after 2 years, and I went back to St. Louis. And I started training at Ballroom Dance Studios. It was Ray Quinlan Studio, and then I also worked at Arthur Murray.
Wow.
Taught me dancing in a hurry. And I developed a nightclub act with a lady named Raina. She was Raina, Queen of the Mambo. And we had a nightclub act, and we would teach poolside, teach the Latin dances poolside at the major hotels, and we'd perform at night. I had an act there. And the Mae West troupe came through and played at the Chase Hotel in St. Louis. They were looking for a dancer, and the muscle men in her show stayed at our hotel. So they would always see our act. We did one act. We did one show later than they did. And they said, we need a dancer. Are you interested? And I said, yes. So I auditioned, and I got the role.
Are you telling me you danced with Mae West?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
That was my first job.
Holy cow.
My first really outside of the nightclub act.
Right.
But so I went to Hollywood, to Ciro's in Hollywood with the Mae West show. And I was there until that closed, and then I hitchhiked back home.
You're kidding.
From L.A., yeah, the days when you
could still do that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when I got home, I went back with Raina, and we started our act again. And then I enlisted in the Army, because I was going to be drafted. Uh-huh. So I enlisted in the Army, and then I auditioned for the Army shows that would come. They would come through auditioning talent to do recruiting films and things like that. So while I was still in basic training, I sneaked down to the service club and I auditioned at night when I wasn't supposed to be out of my bunk.
AW, you know what, right?
And I, orders were cut on me, and I was sent then to Chicago to WGN, which was Fifth Army Headquarters, was in Chicago, and they had a television show at WGN. And I would go up, I was at Fort Riley, and they would bring me up to Chicago twice a month to do a television show.
What did you do?
Danced.
Oh my God.
I didn't sing or anything, I just danced.
Uh-huh.
And the different stuff. And so later on, I auditioned for the All-Army Talent Contest, which was in, that was 1956. And you had to win at your home base. And I had a little dance, I just danced. Improv, you just danced.
Right.
That's all I cared about anyway.
Right.
And so I won in my category. And I was sent to Camp Carson, Colorado, for the Fifth Army area talent contest. And I won in my category there. And then that took me to the international contest at Fort Dix.
Wow.
And I placed third in my category there. And then I got to do the Ed Sullivan Show and perform for the president. And
Eisenhower?
Uh-huh. Oh, like. And then I was put in a musical review. And we toured the world for 7 months.
In the Army?
In the Army.
Wow.
So that was, I wore little cross ballet slippers on my collar. Not really, but I should have.
So, what did you do in the Army?
I danced.
Right.
I danced.
That's right.
And then when I got, when all the shows were over, I had like 4 to 6 months left. And they put me in the library. So I checked out books, the GIs. And then I got out of the Army. I met a friend of mine who was on that tour. It was a great friend named Scott Jackson. And Scotty was a production singer at the La Nouvelle Vague in Paris when he was drafted. And he got out long before I did. And so he went back to Paris. He wired me and said, we need a dancer. Are you interested? Send us a nude photograph.
Send you a nude photograph?
Yes.
Is that what you, I thought you
yes.
said, first I thought, oh, he must have said new.
No, nude.
Because
so
they want a dancer, but, so to speak.
I sent him one in a little bathing suit. And, but they hired me. And so they brought me to Paris. So I was a
because
nude
they
dancer
had,
at La Nouvelle.
They had good imaginations? Is that what?
Well, I didn't have to be totally nude.
Okay.
Even in the show.
Oh, okay.
I wore a little LeMay cup. That was all. And then I was painted.
Wow.
The body was painted silver.
How long were you there?
A year.
Wow, that's
so
great.
So then I spent that, and then I came back to St. Louis. I didn't want to stay in New York yet, so I was a little frightened of all that. And I hadn't done anything that, you know, I had never done a show, a book show. I had only done nightclubs and television, things like that. So I came back to St. Louis. I had a cousin who was a supervisor at Arthur Murray dance studio. Mm-hmm. So he put me to work. And then he bought a studio in Corpus Christi, Texas, a franchise. Asked if I would go with him to help him start the studio. So I moved to Texas. And in Texas, I quit teaching and I got a job as an office boy in an oil company.
Holy cow.
And so I started drawing and lettering. The geological department saw that and asked if I would come to, we're going to be trained as a draftsman. So I said, sure. So I became a geological draftsman and I worked for Coastal States Gas Producing Company for 5 years.
Wow.
And while I was there, I started getting involved in community theater mm-hmm. and a college, Del Mar College, and I met a lady there named Janine Hager, who's no longer with us, God rest her soul. But she's the one who really started me thinking about what choreography was, because I really didn't know.
You were just dancing.
I just danced.
Right.
And, or how that all came about, or how you created that. So,
Was she a dancer?
No, she was a teacher of opera, singer. And she directed, she was head of the musical program, and she directed the shows and stuff, and I was in some of those. And she said, I think you should choreograph. I said, well, I really don't know how to do that. She said, well, you're an artist, you paint pictures, and you dance. And you put those together, that spells choreography.
Wow.
And I said, what? That's interesting. I still don't know how. She said, well, you're going to figure it out because you're choreographing the next show.
Wow.
So that's how I started choreographing. And then I choreographed everything, the book shows, and I performed in them. Like Showboat was my first book musical. I played Frank Schiltz. And I did Peter Pan and Oklahoma and all, you know.
And you loved it.
I loved it. And then we started a summer theater there called the Sandy Shores Summer Theater. And we did all these shows, and then that season was over. We moved to New York. Janine didn't, because she lived there and was a teacher and so forth.
Well, we.
Emily Jefferson, the lighting designer.
Oh, you all, the sort of in...
And Pat Starr, who was a leading lady, and Shirley Caballero, who was a dancer, and myself, and a French poodle named Gypsy. In an old Le Mans convertible, pulling a U-Haul, we drove to New York.
Wow.
And we had some friends there that got us an apartment. And we were in the Village.
Yeah.
So did you ever try to park a U-Haul on Saturday night in Greenwich Village?
Even then.
So we moved in. And
are we talking about the early 60s here?
Talking about 1963.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, because I was 59 when I moved to Texas. And so we were evicted. Because our sublady, or the person we sublet from, never paid the person that he was supposed to pay.
You paid them, but then...
He was subletting, and he resublet to us.
Uh-huh.
So they asked us to move. So that was a funny day, but the three girls enticed the cop, the sheriff, as it were, in New York, and he let us stay another month until we all found a place to mm-hmm. go. And then I found a place in Brooklyn Heights. And I lived there for 13 years and started my career in New York.
Yeah.
I got a job as an artist at an ad agency. And that
worked, a day gig.
Yeah, I worked there for a year. And then I started auditioning, as not choreographing, just performing. And I started performing. And then once I got used to that, I said, I'm not going to work anymore. I'm just going to work in my chosen field, and which was theater. And once I quit, then my career really began to, I mean, quit as a job,
mm-hmm.
my career really began to grow. So I was a working choreographer.
Well, you want to tell us a little bit about what you did? I mean, some of the work you did, some of the shows.
Oh, in New York?
Yeah.
I work mostly a lot out of New York. I mean, people come to New York to mm-hmm. hire you.
Right.
And I did some off-Broadway stuff. Well, Devil's Disciple was just opened here at the Oslo.
Yeah.
I played a role in that off-Broadway, and then I did a lot of review work, and started staging reviews, and I worked at the upstairs at the downstairs,
yes.
which was a wonderful old nightclub,
mm-hmm.
and putting reviews together there. Fabulous people worked there, like Ruthie Buzzy and
Barbara Streisand.
Lily Tomlin and all that bunch. Mm-hmm. And we worked at the Astor Hotel.
Ooh.
Put reviews together there. And I staged some shows for the USO. And I just did a lot of constant work
yeah,
and a
will.
Lot of industrial shows.
Mm-hmm.
I did 45 shows for IBM alone.
Oh my God.
You know, so, and Cannon Mills and all of those wonderful. Crane Supply.
When there was money for that, too.
Yes, and they were such fun. They were, you know, you had wonderful talent
mm-hmm.
to use, and you could, the companies didn't take themselves that seriously, and they loved laughing
mm-hmm.
and laughing at themselves. But then they started, when money became scarce and stuff, they started taking themselves too seriously and didn't want to make fun of each other anymore.
Right.
And that dried up a little bit. At that time, I was, the career, I was signed with William Morris Agency. So they were sending me for stuff, and television opportunities came up. And I went to a slump where it was an almost got this, almost got that, to where it really became very sad. Dwight Hamian and Gary Smith, who produced the Lena Horne specials and Tony Bennett and all that, and Kraft Music Hall,
mm-hmm.
I did a film for William Morris, a promo film of four pieces. They loved that. And they used to hire a choreographer for three shows and a Kraft. And they called my manager, Herman Goldfarb was his name, and they called him and said, we'd like to use Jimmy as the staff choreographer for the season, which was a big break. But the next season, Kraft canceled. They canceled their show.
Oh!
So I lost out there.
Oof.
I lost out the Jim Nabors special because Tony Mordente became free, who was much more of a known choreographer than I. You know, it was those
oh,
kinds
it's
of
the
things.
Business.
It was the business,
yeah,
exactly.
It's the business.
And I started withdrawing a little bit. And my friend Emily, who was a lighting designer that I moved to New York,
yeah.
I bought a house in Connecticut. So I started going up in Connecticut and painting a lot. And I would go up there and I started showing my stuff in a gallery in Wilton, the Wilton Art Gallery. So I started spending more time up there and kind of letting my career slide in New York because it was getting too painful.
Mm-hmm.
And finally an agent, Judy Shane, who was with Brett Adams, called me. And she said, that's ridiculous. Get your ass back here. And I've got a job for you. And I went off and choreographed Sweet Charity up in upstate New York.
Uh-huh.
And that sort of brought me back. And then from then I went to the Alliance Theater in Atlanta, and Theater of the Stars in Atlanta. And I started working with big names and all that. And it became very, very exciting again. And that during that time is when I got a call from Howard Millman at the Oscars.
I was wondering how you wound up here.
I got a call. There was a guy, Jim, what was Jim's last name? I don't remember. Who was a stage manager of a show I did off Broadway. I did Babes in Arms off Broadway. And that was a big boost to my career. That's why William Morris signed me and so forth. And Jim Pruss was his name. He's no longer with us, I'm sorry to say. And but he's an old Army buddy of Howard's. And Jim came to Miami on a show, called Howard to say hello. Howard said, I'm looking for a choreographer. Jim said, I just worked with one. Here's his number.
Wow.
And Howard called me and hired me over the phone.
Wow.
That was 1969. And I came here to do Over the Lovely War. So I did that and loved it. They asked me back the next year to do Dr. Faustus, so I did that. Then they didn't ask me back for a couple of years. And then 1973, they asked me back. And I did Little Mary Sunshine and then worked on about four other shows in the rep. And then I went back to New York and did other things. And then they called and said, would you like to be the movement teacher at the conservatory? And we're moving the conservatory down here. And I said, no. Of course not. And so the next year, they asked me again.
To be the movement person?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
And my career had leveled off. It was the timing, and it was either investigate this new opportunity or stay with the industrial shows or keep kicking my butt in New York trying to see if I could get the big
break. Get a kick, kicking in again.
Yeah,
right.
And So I decided I'm going to go on down to the Oslo, and I came here. And that started my whole career down here.
Yeah.
And it's been a wonderful, rewarding time, because I remember I was at a party. I was thinking of going back to New York at one point. And I was at a party with Gwen Verdon was there. And a wonderful, wonderful lady. And Margaret Hamilton was there.
Oh, my God.
And Thelma Ritter's mother, daughter was there. Thelma's daughter was there, who loved my mother. I had my mother at the same party visiting. It was a Christmas time thing at a man named Gene Lindsay's apartment. And we were talking about, Gwen wanted to know what I did, and I told her all this stuff that I was doing and was excited. And she said, why would you want to come back here? Mm-hmm. She said, that's ridiculous. You're working in a wonderful theater, in a beautiful climate, and you're doing professional work, and you're teaching, and you're working with young people. She said, I can't imagine a better existence.
Wow.
And I said, you're right. So I stayed. And I was here until I went off to Penn State. I got an offer from Penn State, and I went there. I didn't like it there very much. I had wonderful friends, and I loved my house, and I loved the students, but I didn't like the academic world very much. It's different down here because you're in a conservatory, and you're dealing with young professionals, and you're not dealing with all of the academic world, which cannot be very pleasant.
No, and very rigid.
Very, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, became an associate professor at Florida State. And then when I went to Penn State, I was an assistant professor. I took a downgrade, but I wanted to find out what that was all about. And I was there, and I was not tenured. And because a new lady came in, and she just threw everybody out who wasn't tenured.
Wow.
And we used to call her the pit bull in high heels. I won't mention names.
No.
But anyway, I was 55, and I really couldn't get a job in academic anymore, as my field, because they would always hire younger. Mm-hmm. So I went out to East Hampton. My old friend Scott Jackson, who was the production singer,
I remember.
Had an antique shop there, and he lost his friend with AIDS and needed help. So I went out to East Hampton and helped Scotty, and then bought a little house and spent my time developing a career out there, doing faux work for antique dealers
and
decorators. And
back and forth and back and forth.
Yes, so I built a whole new career. Mm-hmm. Became a muralist and all of that. So at the same time, Howard Millman would call me because he was at Jiva Theater at that time.
Yes.
And I would go to Jiva and do work for him, and I would do work for some of the other people. I never stopped working in the theater. And I would go to New York and do some stuff. Alan Ball, I would work with Alan Ball and with his little company in New York. And so suddenly we had a bad storm. It was the 17th of the season in East Hampton. Snow. It was awful. And I got a call at that time from an ex-student of mine named Brant Pope, who was now head of the conservatory, and Howard Millman, when Howard was coming back here.
Right.
He said, would you come down and do Jane Eyre? And Brant said, and teach for a year. I said, yes. And so I sold my house, and I moved it out. I've been here ever since.
Wow.
And it's really been very rewarding, because I'm adjunct faculty now, and they use me as they see fit. Mm-hmm. You know, so they don't overuse me, as I don't see fit. But
I'm sorry, I'm not videoing that.
Right. But no, it's thrilling, and the theater is very thrilling. And
so you just did Winter's Tale, right?
I just did Winter's Tale, and I just did Imaginary Invalid.
Oh, did you?
Yes, and now I'm doing Three Postcards for the conservatory.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, Invalid was wonderful fun. Greg Lemming, who directs, is the head of the conservatory, directed that. And, of course, working with Michael Edwards is he's a brilliant director.
Is he?
Yeah. He knows what he wants. And you give him a lot of stuff, and then he latches on. You know, it's very thrilling to work with him, and naturally there are always changes, which I like.
Mm-hmm. Clearly.
Yeah.
Clearly.
I'm a Gemini. What can I tell you?
Oh, you are.
Yeah.
So wow. So there are all these sides, right?
Yeah.
Because it's true. If you look at the sort of arc of your life, it's sort of, well, we're over here doing this, then we're over here doing that, well, then we'll go over here doing this, we'll do this again.
Right.
And we'll do this over here, now this is a new thing, never mind, we'll do that. You know, it's lovely.
Yeah, it's the way my whole life has been.
Yeah, clearly, clearly. And you have gone where it went.
Yes, I always allowed, Howard Millman always said he envied me that. I lived so much in the moment.
Yes.
And just let life happen to me and then try to take advantage of it.
I suppose we can put some of that down to the Gemini, although I know some fairly rigid Geminis, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
They have a lot of interests and a lot of talents, but they're not necessarily as footloose as you.
Yeah.
So where do you think that comes from?
Oh, my mom, probably. I had a great mother. She was a wonderful woman and just sort of introduced us to a lot of stuff and encouraged us.
And didn't put...
No, she was a Christian Scientist. But if we got sick, we'd go right to the doctor.
So she, too, was very flexible.
Yes, she believed in the philosophies of the religion, but not in the dictates of it, which is kind of the way I believe. I'm not much for organized religion.
Well, you're not much for organized anything. Mm. I mean, you're kind of, you know, as long as it's working, it's okay. And then when it's not, you know.
Then
at least that's what it looks like, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. And it stops being fun.
What's the point?
That's right.
Yeah.
But, no, Mom always introduced us to so many things and let us choose.
Yeah.
And then I read a book when I was in my formative years called East of Eden by Steinbeck.
Yes, I know it well.
And it's all about choice.
Yes.
And I really latched into that as a young man. So you make your choices and you follow through. Good, bad, or indifferent.
And then you take the consequences of those choices.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting, philosophically speaking, I've always been aware that there is, in our culture, a reluctance to take the consequences of the choice.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you have to settle the buck stops.
Yes, right.
You know?
Yeah, right. Okay, make your choices by all means. But
you have to own up.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
It's good for you.
Yeah.
And you always have, really.
I always have. My mom used to say, back to her religion, she would say, your needs will always be met.
Yes.
I say, okay, Mom, off I go. And oddly enough, they have always been met. Now, sometimes, I mean, my needs.
I understand.
You know.
So. No, I absolutely understand it. And that MO, you know, that belief system, that trust, you know, she did give you that.
Yes, she did.
And I do believe that if you believe it, it will be true.
I do.
You know.
And my dad, well, they were divorced when I was 11, and he died when I was 12, and he was only 41 years old.
My.
You know, he died of cancer. And so I really didn't know him all that well. And but with my uncles and my mother's family.
I was just going to say, this is your mother's family.
Yeah, they were very supportive, you know, always.
And to some extent, free spirits.
To some extent, and some were in some, you know, for years, every time I go home, what is it you do? What does that mean? When are you going to get a real job? You know.
Yeah.
And I just smile.
But your mother didn't do that.
Never.
Right.
Never
yeah,
did.
And that's where the...
Or my aunt, my dear aunt, who died this past year. She was 94.
Wow.
And always the same way. One time I was going to leave, not too long ago, I would say... It was probably after I left Penn State, and I didn't know quite. I thought about going back to St. Louis. Mother was in a home. My aunt was by herself. My aunt says, don't come back here. She said, this place would bore you to death. She said, you've lived all over the world. You've seen, you know, so many people, have such good friends in places. She said, I don't think you would be happy coming back here. Come to visit.
So where did your mother and your aunt, I'm assuming that's her sister, how did they come out of a Christian Science family?
Well, it wasn't a Christian Science family. That was only my mom.
That was your mom.
Yeah.
But I mean, you're describing this family as the larger family is a little bit more rigid than your mom. Maybe I got that wrong.
Not all of them. Her father, I never knew, I'm sorry to say. was a fun-loving Irishman.
Ah.
And he's the one who started, he had five kids, and he started them all playing instruments.
Wow.
So that's how they all played. And he would have them all beating drums and marching around the house. And he would just love, he did all that, you know, but he was a real fun-loving man, as were all of my three uncles. There were three boys and two women. They were all fun-loving.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
I didn't find that much rigidity or, I'm sure there were prejudices and...
Well, I was thinking about that part, you know, the what are you doing, what is that, you know,
Well, I used to get that from the married aunts.
I never got that from my
immediate family.
Right.
Or even my uncles.
Right, yeah. Okay, so that means, so your mother came by it naturally. I mean, that's I got it.
And her mother, my grandmother, was German. But she was the iron hand of the family.
Right, so we had the fun-loving Irishman and the German who's taking care of everything.
That's right.
Right.
But it was quite a family.
Yeah, and they did real well by you.
Oh, yeah, they did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I like to ask people if there's anything I didn't ask you or anything that you would like to say about a life like the one you've had or a life in art. Or
no, I've just been very grateful.
Yeah.
I really have. I've been very fortunate.
Yeah.
In the people I've met, the friends I've made, and in health.
Yeah.
Knock on wood.
Yeah.
Because I'll be 75 in June.
My God.
You know, so I've done fine.
You've done fine.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Did you want to talk anything about
Winter's
Tale at all?
Well,
just that it was a wonderful experience, mm-hmm. and it was usually I'm not. Being a purist, and I wrote my book on the dances of Shakespeare.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And so on about the actual dances that he did and how to do them. But I did put a segment in about conceptual directors who do concepts of Shakespeare. And
many do.
Many do. Most of them now.
Yeah, right.
And different dances. For instance, if you're doing a galliard, as in his time, Shakespeare's time, and you did it in the 1920s, if you would do a Charleston.
So. Ah.
A dance that is equivalent to mm-hmm. in tempo and feeling and spirit as the Shakespeare. So I have a whole area in that in the book also. But I wrote it for directors and choreographers and students, mm-hmm. for people who want to know about the origin of some of those dances. Because the books that are wonderful that are written, but they're hard to understand if you're a layman.
Mm-hmm.
And this I tried to put in layman terms and have fun.
I didn't realize that. So where did you learn that?
Research. The Oslo was terrific for me because I'd only sang and danced and giggled.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And they started having me do stuff in the classical works.
So you had to research
I had to research everything. Because Bob Strain and Eb Thomas, who were the co-artistic directors, really pushed you to the top of your talent. They really demanded more and more, and they pushed you. So you began to learn more and more and more. So I researched so much when I had to do the classics with them. And I learned so much. So that's
when
how
when did you write the book?
2000, I don't know, about 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on sale at Amazon, and they have it in the guest and the, you know,
at the Oslo?
At the Oslo, there, mm-hmm. in the gift shop. But when I did the Michael left some things out of the dances, out of the concept,
mm-hmm.
here. Because I said, aren't we going to do the dance of the 12 satyrs? He said, no. I said, okay.
How many dances are there?
Oh, there's like three.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Three moments where there's dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And Shakespeare would always say in his parentheses, they dance. He never says what they dance.
Really?
Rarely ever.
So then how do you know?
Well, because of what he suggests, the kind of the banquet or what you do. Is it a mask, you know?
Oh, I see. And so then you would, having done the research, you know what's the appropriate dance in that
situation. Yes, exactly.
I see.
And then I say, here's what you can do in lieu of.
Yes, right.
Of the appropriate dance. And so, in fact, I have to talk on this tomorrow to the educators of high schools here.
Really?
In the area.
Yeah, this is such a special I mean, I wouldn't think there's very many books on
it. Right. And I illustrated it.
Did you? Of course you did. Of course you did. I'll bet it was great fun.
It was fun.
Yeah. That's great.
So anyway, it was great fun working on that show because he put it in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to do all the equivalent work. And he doesn't know exactly what he wants at the steps you use, but he knows what he doesn't want.
And he knows it when he sees it.
And he knows it when he sees it.
Yeah.
And then that's great. We have a lot of fun with that.
Yeah.
You know, he'll say, no, that's too dancey. I want more something like this. Because I did Equus with him, too, which was really fun to do. Because we took it very dancey and then started editing it way back to have a reality to it.
Mm-hmm.
But all those processes, and you work with these wonderful people, it's just very, very exciting to
do. I can see it. I can see
and
it.
And Bob Turhoff is wonderful to work with.
You know,
I have a blast with him.
I know.
You know.
Yeah, it's the process, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't like to sit in the audience.
No,
you know,
well,
once it opens, the baby's born.
but the creative process, you know, I mean the really being in it and making it happen.
Well, some directors and people said, well, don't get upset if they want stuff changed. And I said, no, because there's too many choices.
Yeah.
And if there's something that I absolutely love, well, I've seen it done.
Yes, and done it.
Others might not have seen it
right.
done, but
and,
I've seen
and
it done.
And done it, right.
Yes, so that's all part of the process, and it gets very exciting.
Yeah, and of course, theater is, I mean, completely collaborative.
Yes.
You know.
And it has to be.
Yes, and not everybody
sometimes
can do that.
Sometimes it's not, you know.
Well,
if you're dealing with
a certain kind
certain
of director.
Type of director.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Well, but it is. They... I mean, well, maybe you're right. Yeah, maybe it isn't. But when it's at its best, I think it is.
Oh, yes.
You know?
Yeah, I do too. And the actors participate in that.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
They've got to have the, be able to use those wings.
Yeah. And so it's there's a bonding that takes place in addition to the fact that you're making this thing and, you know.
I did a show one time on the other coast where they wanted me to come in with everything and just teach it. And I said, what you're doing is stopping a hunk of my creative process.
Yes.
Because I have to design on the people.
Right.
I have to see what they can do and what looks best on them. And so it was not a pleasant
experience. because they insisted.
Yeah, they were angry because I wanted the time.
Oh.
You see, they want you to come in and teach it. I said, well, I can't do that. Once the director felt that I knew what I was doing, he treated me more like a peer, like we were co-directing.
Right. Yeah, right.
And once he had that feeling, then we got along great. I always liked the director. I thought he was a terrific guy and great fun. But it was just that he was cutting my creative hands.
Was it because of the time that he didn't want to spend the time? Is that what you think?
No, I think it was because he had only worked with Ronnie the choreographer, and that's what that person always did for him.
Ah, yes.
So he thought that's the way it was done.
Yes. And he must have thought that was the professional way.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yes. So, and he got very frustrated with me, and I felt sorry about that, but I'm sorry.
I love it.
But those are things you go through creatively,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And the show turned out very well, and I had a Carbondale nomination and everything else from it, but
some people also have trouble trusting.
Well, that's true too.
You know, that's true.
You find that a lot.
Yeah.
But you got to get past that. You find that with staff members occasionally. You find it with actors and directors. You know, you find it with dancers and choreographers. You know,
and accountants and lawyers.
You find that in everything, exactly.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's really, it really is the ability. And again, the way you've lived your life is really based on trust.
Yeah.
You know, it will be all right, I will be all right, this will be, you know. And that isn't very common.
Yeah, I guess it's not.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
It's not. It's very lovely.
Yeah.
I'm happy for you.
Thanks.
And I do believe that it all goes back to your mother, and God bless her.
Yeah, I think it does.
You know?
Yeah. Very, And she only had an eighth grade education. She was always self-conscious about that.
Yeah, that's a shame.
But she was so wise.
It's a shame because that what she gave you, you can't learn in school.
No. Well, she was teaching piano at a conservatory when she was 14.
Oh, my God.
You know, because she had to quit school to help the family.
Like but her father had made sure everybody could play an instrument.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
No fool he.
Yes. And he died at a very young, early age also, which forced their family to have to do that.
Wow, instead, yeah, you know. Right.
And in those days they did.
Yeah, they did.
Very close. But, no, I've been very fortunate. And as I said, there are so many choices that you can really allow so much to happen in your creative work.
Yes. You know. And if you let in your life.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, even when I stretch, I used to tell my students, allow the muscles to work. Allow the stretch. Don't fight it.
Don't fight it. Or don't push it.
Yeah.
That's the other one, you
right.
know.
Just breathe through it.
Right. It will, yeah. if you let it.
If you let it.
Right. If you let it, it will stretch.
That's
right.
Nice. In fact, there's a girl teaching at a conservatory in New York City right now who's teaching what she calls all my techniques, and she was one of my students here.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, Connie Rotunda. And she's about that big around. I gave her all of my notes and everything else to use. You know, so it's nice to see your work carried on.
Yes, it is.
And we're having the reunion, you know, the conservatory reunion's coming next month.
Oh, my gosh.
And so many are coming back. And it's wonderful to see the people you've teached be successful and things like that. It's such a, makes your chest swell a bit.
You know. Well, yeah, what you do is all about giving it away.
Yeah. Dan Donahue, who has the lead in Winter's Tale.
And who I'm going to be interviewing this
week. He was one of my students at Penn State.
Oh, you're kidding!
Yeah.
Oh, how funny.
One of my grad students. So I was very proud to see Dan when he came to town. And he's had a wonderful career. He's just a superb actor.
Yeah.
His Devil's Disciple.
Oh, really?
Which opened last night.
Yeah.
He was phenomenal, just wonderful. Or night before last, I guess it was Friday. Yes, so. And Jimmy Clark, you know, has been a member of the company. He's one of my students. So, yeah, it's very rewarding to see all that happen, you know.
Yeah. So is there anything you haven't done or anything that you're looking to do? Or is there a...
No.
Just more of the same?
I would like to paint more, I think. And there's a book I would like to write that I'm working on. And, you know, I have projects in my head that I
would
like
to
do.
Yes, I'm sure you do. I mean, that's very Geminian anyway. But.
Well, it is. Like the book I wrote, the Shakespeare book, I procrastinated for about 20 years. And I said, I should write this book. People keep calling me and saying, what's this and what's that? And
you can say it's in my book.
I should write something. So I sat down, you know, took me a month.
All right, but
you done with me?
Yeah, I am.
All right.
Thank you.
All right.
Say goodbye, Jimmy.
Bye. I hope it makes some sense.
And of course, I was certainly not done with Jimmy. I'm not sure what else to say about this. Jimmy came into my life much too close to the end of his, but what he gave me from the generosity of his spirit, from his incredible bounty, I will have for my whole life. And I know that this is true for legions of us. I just hope that listening to Jimmy has inspired you as he always inspired me to reach for what was best about me, about what was natural to me, just as he always did. So, as always, I hope you got something from this show that you can use. Something that inspired you, something that he told you that you didn't know, something that I told you that you didn't know. Something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang.